From WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch in today for Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is one that a lot of us probably wish had never been made, the one between purveyors of conspiracy theories and a growing number of Americans who believe them and who've made them part of the political mainstream. It's by no means a new chapter in American life, but it's become especially pervasive in the last few years, and we are fortunate to be joined in this hour by an expert on the topic. Scott Tyson is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Rochester, teaches a class on political conspiracy theories in American politics. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So glad you could join us for this hour. Let me start by asking you, what led to your interest in studying this topic and in teaching about it? What got you, from the other side of it, hooked on conspiracism, as it were?
So I've always told people that conspiracism and conspiracy theory, there's always an entertaining aspect to it. And I'd always kind of had a passing interest just for entertainment value in conspiracy theories. You know, going back to the X-Files, when I was young, I was a fan of the X-Files. And I noticed in, 2015, 2016, political conspiracies and conspiracism related to politics, there was a growing influence, and it really picked up and took off around 2016. And so I wanted to understand that more. So the best way I thought to really be able to dive into it was to teach a class and experience it with other people. So it wasn't really a class, and still isn't. I've taught it a couple of times now. It's not really a class where I lecture to people, but it's more of active engagement. Like, we're all figuring this out together. So it's been a really great experience to do that.
And in a way, I guess you could say we have all collectively been figuring this out together. I don't even have to ask you what was going on in 2015 and 2016 that suddenly made this a topic of interest. It's kind of obvious. How much, though? I mean, this, as I mentioned in the introduction, this obviously is something that to some extent has always been somewhere in American politics. It's not obviously new. Delve into us a little bit before we get into current conspiracism and the distinction between that and conspiracy theories. Take us back a little bit in history. When else can you point to, if at any point in American history, where this whole conspiracy-minded outlook has been so acute?
What do you mean by like where it's been so important in politics, or
where it's driven so much of the day-to-day discourse, and where we've seen really an entire arm of American politics devote itself to pursuing some of these theories?
That's a great question. So it's a long answer, but I'll give you a short version. So there's a book.
We got an hour. You
paranoia.
Can go along.
There's a book on paranoia in the U.S. and how it's been used, and it goes back to the Great Awakening and how various pockets of different Protestant sects would employ kind of conspiracist narratives as part of their recruiting in little villages. But more recently, where it became the most important was during Reconstruction. There were a lot of different conspiracies circulating in the South as a way to undermine the Reconstruction efforts and states being pulled back into the Union. And a lot of what we see today around voting rights and things like that are related in some way, at least the narrative around them is related to conspiracies that cropped up around the end of the Civil War during Reconstruction. So we've seen conspiracism play a role politically. It just kind of ebbs and flows. They become more important during certain periods of time and less important during others.
Is it fair to say that it has something to do with moments when there is a political movement that depends on a fear of the other, whatever the other is at that time in politics?
Absolutely. It's hard to say how much of it is, imposed from the outside, or whether it's just a rhetorical strategy that gets developed by certain groups or certain political interests as a way to galvanize some part of what they see as their base. So in other words, it's an intentional strategy. It's not something that happens by accident.
Define, I want to get this definition out here early, and I mentioned this briefly, conspiracy theory versus conspiracism, because you draw a distinction there.
Yeah, great. That's a great question. And I really push this distinction because I think it's really important. So I think of conspiracy theories as the kind of things that we associate with the X-Files, for lack of a better example, but these grand theories that link together seemingly disparate events as being part of some, you know, grand conspiracy. And there's always a lot of detail. It takes a lot of effort to become initiated into these conspiracies, to know how all of the pieces fit together. Right? They're really characterized by the level of detail that you need to know in order to engage with them at all. But the other side of that, which is what's used more politically today, is what I call conspiracism. And actually, I've taken this from other scholars. It's a distinction that's been around for a few years. But conspiracism is more assertion without evidence. So just asking questions or, you know, what's going on over here. And a lot of the conspiracies that we see going on today around, for instance, the recounts in Arizona, there's not so much a grand theory as to how these all fit together, but just baseless assertions that always put on the other side, you have to prove this assertion is wrong, rather than providing a detailed account. So conspiracy theories are, here's my detailed account, tell me this isn't true, whereas conspiracism is more, here's my baseless assertion, you now must convince me that that baseless assertion is false.
So getting back to what happened in 2015 and 2016, obviously you have a figure now in American politics in the form of Donald Trump as candidate and then as president, who is going out and making a lot of these assertions. We have seen candidates make assertions like this before, but to this extent, in this number, with this level of believability, put him in a broader context here as to what made this particular moment pop in the way that it did.
I think he was particularly situated to the moment. I don't think he created it, but he slotted in at the time that someone who's willing to just assert things without any evidence or reason to believe that they're true, just because he feels it to be true. It was a moment that was suited to him, and he's relentless in his, he'll assert just about anything. Sometimes maybe things he asserts are true, and oftentimes they're not. But he doesn't care, is my impression. He doesn't really care whether things are true or not.
Do you think, and we'll delve into this a little bit deeper in the broader context of the people who follow these movements, there's no way of knowing, obviously. Do you think he believes that these assertions are true, whether it's something as small as a record number of people at the inauguration at the beginning of this, or as large and potentially consequential 4.5 years later as I didn't lose the election?
I mean, I don't know exactly what goes on in his mind. My impression is he doesn't care whether it's true or not. He knows that if he asserts things, people will believe it, and that's what he cares about. Why would he care if they're true?
Fair enough. We are talking with Scott Tyson, assistant professor of political science at the University of Rochester, about conspiracism and conspiracy theories. We welcome you into the discussion as well. You can give us a call at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. I'm on Twitter at Scott Feibusch. You can find me there too. And we would love to have your input into today's conversation. There is, obviously, if it's just one person saying these things, it doesn't go very far. When he says these things, especially before certain platforms barred him, it went a lot further. Let's turn this discussion a little bit towards the role that outside factors play, and we'll shine the spotlight back on all of us and this broad thing that we generically call the media. And obviously that's a very broad generalization for a whole bunch of different places with different motives. But you've studied and you've written about the role that media amplification plays, sometimes unwittingly, in spreading these. Let's go over in that direction a little bit and turn the conversation that way.
So do you mean like what does media do, traditional media do, and how do they assist in these narratives being spread?
Right, and sometimes without even necessarily intending to do so.
Right. I think the one thing that's the most important that happens a lot in media is I think some people have called laundering the lie. And the idea is if I want to, let's suppose that I want to get some conspiracy out there, then it's all about trying to get someone more credible than me to repeat it. Whether they're fact-checking it or not largely doesn't matter. So if I make a claim and some major media outlet, CNN, NBC News, ABC News, one of those picks it up, repeats my claim, and then fact-checks it, the idea of fact-checking the claim always puts forward the idea that someone in the intended audience could disagree with the fact-checking, but that claim that I've made is now in their heads. And so traditional media sort of inadvertently, by trying to bring truth to the debate or holding the lies to account, actually spread the lie more than they should.
And certainly, I mean, in the early years of this, and this in a way gets back to your explanation of what got you into it. I mean, yeah, the X-Files was entertaining. The truth is out there. There are aliens that we don't know about, and somebody's hiding it from us. That's basically harmless. There's a self-flagellation that has happened, I think, in a lot of corners of the media landscape in recent years, saying, hey, a lot of us, especially at the very beginning, said, oh, isn't this funny? The guy who used to host The Apprentice is riding down an escalator saying he's going to run for president. Let's cover this because it's entertainment. Is that a fair assessment that was one of the seeds of this problem early on?
I think that because conspiracy narratives and the people who are willing to peddle them are so entertaining, it's very seductive not to cover them, not to talk about them, because it's fun. It's fun to talk about. There's nothing wrong with it being fun to talk about, but I think there are a lot of indirect effects of embracing that entertainment that we're living with today.
So what are go a little deeper. What are some of those effects? What do you pick out as having been some of the more deleterious effects of that?
I think every time someone makes a claim, regardless of how absurd it may seem, there's people who will believe it. And when you provide a megaphone to those views, you're going to galvanize some people who will believe those things, not necessarily because they think they're true, maybe they do, I don't know, but because that's how they form a group. People who are entertained by the same things, that's one way that we all form groups with each other. Game of Thrones fans, things like that. And I think the impulse to say, oh, look, he's saying this, or he came down the escalator and said all this crazy stuff. Let's talk about how crazy that was. The entire audience that witnesses that discussion about how crazy those things were, not all of them are going to think it's crazy. Some of them are going to find it persuasive. And that's an indirect effect in that, oh, you and I are going to have a conversation about how all this stuff is crazy, but some people aren't going to see it as crazy. They're going to see it as, oh, that makes a lot of sense to me. And that would be an indirect effect of our discussion about how crazy some things are.
So what are the factors in that? What makes that distinction between somebody who can just laugh it off and say, oh, that's silly. I know it's not true. I'm going to be amused hanging out on the internet discussing this for an hour, but I'm not going to act on any of this, and it's not going to affect how I live the rest of my life. And the people who embrace this wholeheartedly, believe in the truth of it, and perhaps are led down a more radical path to do things like what we saw happen at the Capitol on January 6th.
I mean, that's a great question, and it's an ongoing thing that we're all trying to understand, both academically and not. So unfortunately, I don't have a great answer to it. But one thing I will say that I think is important to remember, and I tell students this when I teach the class on conspiracism, is we've witnessed one sequence of events where people, you know, some people heard some things and they found it persuasive, and the rest of us look at it and we're like, but that's kind of kooky and crazy. I can't believe people believe that. But it's all relative. And the reality is, we're all, no one's really immune to thinking, you know, to being paranoid or thinking conspiratorially about certain things. We all kind of exist on a spectrum of how willing we are to believe those things. And, you know, so it's not helpful, I think, to look at, you know, okay, those people believe this kooky conspiracy, I'm different from them. Really not. It's that, okay, you know, they found those particular things persuasive. I could have been duped by something else. I wasn't duped by that. But, you know, we're all susceptible to being duped by those kind of things based on a bunch of different factors, all of which we don't collectively understand. We don't know what all of those factors are. And that's sort of, I think, the next important step to try to break the hold of conspiracism politically on us, is to try to start breaking up these factors and seeing how all of these things work together, because there's not one explanation or one factor. It's a complicated web of things.
Which is a terrifying thought, especially for those of us who have the power of sitting behind a microphone talking to and perhaps influencing people, because
right.
I obviously don't want to believe that I could be led down that path, or even worse, lead listeners down that path. So what can I do? What can all of us do who are, you know, in the media, should be aware of this? What's the best piece of advice for somebody who's just been scared by a statement like that to move forward and to address that and try to be conscious of it?
Unfortunately, I don't have a ready-made formula, but I think the first thing that you should always be aware of is, you know, how likely was I to believe this thing, right? There are all these things that, you know, you hear them or you see them on Twitter or whatever, and you kind of go, ha, figures, I knew it. But those are the things you should be the most suspicious about, because it means you were willing, you were already kind of predisposed to believe it. And then also thinking through, it's like conspiracies are always, one common thing of conspiracies or various conspiratorial narratives is you have to kind of do the common sense gut check. I mean, how many people needed to be in on a secret for it to hold true? Is this the simplest explanation for the thing that it's trying to explain, or is it needlessly complicated? Kind of like a parsimony test. That's how I use it. And it's not perfect. I'm not saying, you know, this will protect you forever, or this will protect you against any kind of paranoid conspiratorial narrative, but it's kind of a good test, the parsimony test. Is this the simplest way this could have come about, or, you know, is it needlessly complicated?
This is the moon landing theory that says it's much easier to believe and understand that we actually landed on the moon than that all of Hollywood and NASA and the government have kept it completely hidden from us somehow for 52 years and counting, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. The great example is if you try to figure out how much would it have cost to fake the moon landing photos, which I think the one thing that was the hardest to fake was the light, where the light was coming from. They would have needed lasers to mimic the kind of light that the sun produces on the moon. And the sheer cost of the lasers in the late 60s would have been more than actually sending someone to the moon. So there's a parsimonious explanation of it actually was simpler to go to the moon than to fake the photographs with the technology at the time.
That, and then also, I mean, we know that people are bad at keeping secrets. Stuff gets out. Stuff wants to get out. And, you know, at least to me, as I think a rationally thinking person sitting here, you know, the idea that everybody could have kept this hidden for half a century, just, you know, to me, it boggles the mind. But there's a mentality on the other side that says it's important for me to know something that not everybody does and to have uncovered this. And it becomes a point of pride for some people, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think that another good litmus test for a conspiratorial narrative is if you try to keep a secret among more than three people, it's nearly impossible. We all are susceptible to gossip, and if I know something that no one else knows, how long can I really keep that a secret? it's hard for people, it's hard for small groups of people to keep secrets that aren't even that interesting. So now imagine that they have this incredibly interesting secret. How would they manage to keep their lips sealed for a month?
And that's a pretty big secret right there, yeah, for somebody to hang on to for that long. We are talking with Scott Tyson, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Rochester. We welcome your calls as well at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Obviously, another piece, and you're right that there are a lot of factors that all went into this moment in 2015 and 2016 and beyond as we're looking at the, you know, at who the candidate was, at his particular celebrity status, let's get into that for a moment too, because there seems to be, at least to my mind, something of a nexus between celebrities and conspiracy theories. Is that just a factor of people wanting to believe things from people who are familiar to them? Where does that come in?
I think that's certainly a factor, but you know, celebrity culture has allowed us, we feel like we know people who we've never met or talked to. And so there's like a instinctual trust we have of these people because we feel like we know them when we don't. And talking about, you know, 2015, 2016, Donald Trump used his pre-existing celebrity and his command of the media environment. There's a symbiosis between him and the media that really took hold at that time.
Media, of course, in the sense of those of us who are reporting one to many, social media obviously was a huge factor in this too, and a new factor, at least a newish factor, in more recent elections. What about the ability of a figure like a Donald Trump to tweet to 3 million people at once? And what too, you know, you mentioned feeling like you know somebody, and obviously on social media, a lot of times you can feel like you know somebody who you'll never meet, and they could be planting all kinds of ideas with you, and they may not even be who they say they are. How has that changed the game?
I think it's also the same kind of thing. We're kind of fooled to trust certain people on social media. Or accounts, really, right? They're not necessarily even one person. Because we interact with them, I think, you know, similar to catfishing, you can be duped on social media because you want to trust people. You, even when you interact with them, you exchange messages with them over and over and over again. You feel like you're developing a relationship, and most of the time you are. But sometimes, you know, you're not, and you're being duped.
And in some cases, not even from within the country. I want to get to that and to conspiracy theories sometimes that come from the other end of the political spectrum as we continue with Scott Tyson, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Rochester. We're going to take our one quick break of the hour. We will be back in 60 seconds with more Connections. Next hour on Connections, you know them by their first names, Susan, Linda, Nina, and Cokie. They're the founding mothers of NPR, and 50 years after the network opened for business, they're the subject of a new book by author Lisa Napoli. She joins us to talk about how these pioneering women shaped the sound of public radio and how the network almost didn't survive its first few years. It's all next as Summer Book Week continues on Connections. Join us. We are back on Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson all this week, except we should note for tomorrow when Evan will be back in here in the noon hour with the results of the primary elections, and we have coverage starting tonight at 9 as well on AM 1370 and WXXINews.org. I wanted to remind you, we will be here with the returns tonight. We are talking with Scott Tyson from the University of Rochester. We're talking about conspiracy theories. We welcome your calls at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. On Twitter, I am at Scott Feibusch. David on Twitter asks, does Tyson believe that modern-day political conspiracy theories have the same longevity or power as some of the, I guess we'll call them, greatest hits, like the Kennedy assassination or the fake moon landing conspiracy theories? And what does he think the long-term impact of these new conspiracy theories will have on politics? So first question first, are these going to be long-running theories? Are people 60 years from now still going to be all over whatever the successor to the internet is by then, explaining in detail exactly why the Arizona ballots were actually made of bamboo that was imported from China, and therefore the results should have been thrown out?
Unfortunately, I think some of them will stick around. Most of them won't, is my suspicion. I think a lot of them will just fizzle out. Because if you think through some of the conspiracies that were going around in 2016, only a few have really survived, or they morphed. The one I think that probably has the most lasting power is QAnon. Even if it changes form, for instance, it's really an offshoot of the Pizzagate conspiracy that the Clintons and Democrats were running something out of a pizza restaurant in D.C. That conspiracy kind of fizzled out, but then it morphed into QAnon. And so I think that basic narrative is going to be around with us for a really long time. I don't know necessarily about the Arizona bamboo ones. Maybe that one will be around. It's hard to predict, but that one could just as easily fizzle out.
You know, we could go very deep in the rabbit hole. It's very easy, I know, to spend a lot of time on Twitter following some of the people who document these things obsessively, even from the fact-checking side of things. One of my favorite follows, Brooke Binkowski out on the West Coast, who tweets as Brooklyn Marie. I think does a great job of digging into a lot of these and kind of trying to expose the network that she says lurks behind some of these. Where do you think, let's talk about Q a little bit, because obviously QAnon was a potent force in last year's election. It's this idea, as I understand it, originated on some of these sort of deep web message boards, or 8chan and 8kun and these, that, you know, there is somebody out there who is a deep, deep insider in the government who is slowly dribbling out all of these very coded secrets that you really have to understand, that tell you that there is this force that's happening that's deeper than you understand behind the government. Do I have that basically right? And what is your theory of who actually is behind this and where it's actually coming from?
First, I don't have a theory in particular of who it is and where it comes from. I think there's a HBO documentary that deals with that in some pretty good detail, so I won't repeat that. What's interesting about QAnon and what makes it different from other conspiracies are these things you mentioned just now, which there are these hints that get dropped and things like the coded messages that are occasionally posted, although I think there hasn't been one posted in quite some time now. But what QAnon did differently than other existing conspiracies was it was much more gamified. So you could engage with it in kind of a game kind of fashion. I get to play through different scenarios and things like that. Another thing that makes Q different, or QAnon different than other conspiracies, is it seems like people's engagement with it is much more, it's like play at your own level. So if you look through different, if you look through QAnon, the narrative kind of splinters off into different, almost sects of what people believe. So for example, some people believe that John F. Kennedy Jr. is Q, and some people believe that John F. Kennedy Jr. is dead. Some people believe both of those things at the same time, but there's a sense in which someone's engagement with QAnon, they need not go down the rabbit hole. They kind of know the overarching skeleton of the narrative, but they don't really need to get into the details. My suspicion, again, I've not collected data on this or done a survey or anything like that, but if one were to do such a thing, you know, be a number of problems or a number of challenges one would have to overcome to do that in a good faith way. But my suspicion is that you would not be able to find a large group of people who are QAnon adherents and that believe the same, that could recount the same narrative of the QAnon belief. They would all have slight variations on it, which is what makes it have kind of a lasting power. It's gamified. It's very entertaining to get involved in, and people can kind of, you know, buy into what they want. and they don't have to buy into the whole thing. It's not a whole conspiracy you have to believe. You can just believe parts of it. And that makes it very powerful and spreadable.
Which kind of brings up the question, too, and speaking particularly of power in relation to this, you know, there was never, at least to my recollection as a student of American history, there's never been a major political bloc at the highest levels of American politics that kind of predicated a lot of their actions on the idea that the moon landing was fake or that the John F. Kennedy assassination was some sort of conspiracy. And yet we're seeing in this particular case that there is a significant presence now in the Capitol, and even more so, it looks like perhaps in state government and in local government, that is adopting these from positions of power. Is that a new thing? Is that something we should be especially concerned about?
That is something we should be especially concerned about because, you know, you mentioned the moon landing being fake and the JFK conspiracies. In both of those cases, we didn't have a major political party that kind of flirted with those ideas as part of their political platform. And now we do. And so we're seeing a completely we're seeing the conspiratorial narrative and how it draws people together manifest completely differently because it's not only a political conspiracy theory, but it's being politicized as part of a party.
And I, you know, let's take this out then to Arizona, where we are seeing this so-called audit taking place in Arizona that is completely, at least again to my knowledge, unique in American political history and very much divergent from anything that's ever happened in the tallying post facto of election returns, where the Arizona Senate, led by the Republican Party, has just completely handed things over to some group. And again, here's where the questions come up on the other side, because there are all kinds of allegations. If you watched Rachel Maddow last night, she had a whole set of allegations about who's behind some of what's happening with the recount, so-called, in Arizona. Are you following this? What's your read on what's happening with this and how this plays into some of these conspiracy-minded ideas?
So I have not been following it in that much detail, which I think is the right approach, because part of the problem with conspiratorial narratives and how this all echoes and makes itself worse is, you know, I think that the Arizona vote initially was legitimate. And so all of these efforts, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who's doing them and what it is, because it's just fodder to continue this conversation on both sides.
Is there a danger, though, if a narrative emerges? You know, the expectation, I think, is that at whatever point they declare this process to be finished, that they're going to come up with some sort of declaration saying what they've essentially been paid to say, which is that this was fake and here's data that appears to prove it. People are going to believe that, some people, right?
Of course.
What do we do about it?
I think we address that data that they disclose.
Okay, with that in mind, I want to go to the phones at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. And John in Rochester, you're on with Scott Tyson on Connections. Hi, John.
Hey, Scott. Hey, Professor. Professor, I watched probably about 30 hours of state legislative hearings in the battleground states back in January. I watched them on YouTube, C-SPAN, televised some of it, whatever. The evidence was unbelievably overwhelming that there was voter fraud. Did you see those hearings at all? If you didn't, you should. It's shocking to see.
I did not see them.
You have to tune in. It's unbelievable about the evidence. They had over 900 affidavits of testimony on various, between stuffing the ballot boxes to voter intimidation at the polling places, computer and software manipulation. There were so many aspects of it. It was mind-boggling. You should see it.
All right, John.
I'll look for it.
John,
thank
thanks for the call. So there, I think Scott Tyson is probably an example of someone who has watched things, has seen something now that he believes to be true. Where do you then make a connection to somebody who believes that there was voter intimidation and who believes that ballot boxes were stuffed, which are things we should say for which I certainly have not seen the kind of evidence that is being alleged here?
So first off, let me say I'm not an expert on election security, and there are certainly people who you know, that's their job, is to know those things. And that's the person I would go to first. Kind of, what do we expect? What do we expect in a normal election time? Because a lot of the, again, this is just my casual impression, not being an expert on election security. My impression is that there are certain glitches and things like that. You know, I don't want to call them irregularities, because that presupposes what irregularity is, which I don't know. So a lot of the things, assertions that I've seen, don't make comparisons to previous elections. Okay, so there was this glitch here, this glitch here. Okay, in an election that you would say was normal, what kind of glitches do we see? Do we see those same glitches? And what I have seen from people who are election security experts, they've said, well, comparing it to the last 4, 5, 6 presidential elections, we did not see more irregularities. In fact, we saw less irregularities. Whatever that really means, because what irregularity isn't clear. So I would say, you know, can you always find glitches in computer systems, glitches and how an election is? I'm sure you can, but what's kind of the normal rate? What's the base rate? That's the right comparison to make. Affidavits, I think anyone can file an affidavit. So
exactly, which gets to this whole issue of, you know, what constitutes an expert in these days. And our producer Rob points out that, you know, in the era of Google, everybody can spend time trying to come up with something that backs up whatever narrative they have. But how do you distinguish? How do you kind of sanitize and say, okay, this is an expert whose authority I can trust. This is somebody whose authority I can't trust. And this brings us around to, I mean, you've talked about 2015 and 2016. I want to talk also about 2020 and into 2021 and what we have seen, you know, with all of the theories about the pandemic, and then especially with a lot of the information that or non-information that's been out there about vaccines that has had potentially a very significant effect on actual public health for all of us. So let's start with this question of, how do you differentiate an expert? How do I know that if I'm watching Dr. Fauci on TV, that, okay, here is somebody who I can trust?
I think there's two parts to that answer. The first is, you know, understanding who's an expert. But you don't, a lot of people, I think, are hesitant just to kind of, okay, that person has a PhD in this, and so, you know, I'm going to trust everything they say. And I don't think that's the right answer. I think, you know, kind of knowing what the environment, who's listening to who. If a lot of doctors are listening to Dr. Fauci, then maybe there's a reason that they're doing that. And so there's some sense of, what does the community of scholars really believe, or who are they listening to? That's one way to judge that. The other way, which I think is really important, I'm going to go back to the class that I teach on conspiracism, because that's one thing that I worried about with students when I started teaching that class was, you know, what's the takeaway? I don't want to teach a class that's just, here's how conspiracism has been weaponized and used politically, and you know, what are we, you know, what are we to do, right? And so what I end up doing is I end the class by going through a book, which I found incredibly helpful, called Calling, by Ted Bergstrom and Jevin West. And the reason I do that is because there's so much information out there, and the internet has really, you know, it's like a fire hose of information that is coming at us all the time. But most of it is, and so the way
just to just really, a reminder here, we're on broadcast, so we got to be a little careful with our language here.
Oh, sorry. Most of it is just crap. It's just not. It's not related to the truth at all. It's simply meant to confuse or to kind of drown out other sources of information. And so the real way to, you know, is to educate yourself on, like, okay, how do I tell whether a claim is something that's valuable, something that could actually be informative, and whether it's just crap. So and I'll give you a little history on it because we have time, right?
We do. We got about 10 minutes left.
Okay. So there's one thing I talk about, and I talk to other people. So people teach on disinformation, misinformation. I'm sure you've heard that term before. And this is connected to how the Russians used propaganda, which is different from disinformation. So propaganda is typically classified as, if I'm the propagandist, I'm trying to convince you of a particular thing. But disinformation is different. I'm not trying to convince you of any particular thing. I'm just trying to confuse you. And a lot of the information that we see on the internet today and the 2020 ballot recalls kind of have these markers. I'm not saying what they are. I'm not the expert on the 2020 election recounts. But they have these hallmarkers of, there's not one theory about this is how, you know, the election was stolen. There's a bunch of different ones, and they all come from the same place. And so what you see is the person who's putting forward the information, they're not trying to convince me of one particular thing as a propagandist would do. They're just trying to put out a bunch of different narratives, hoping that some of them will stick, which is a classic disinformation campaign. That's what disinformation does. It gives you a bunch of different accounts without really endorsing any of them, hoping that with some people, this one will stick, with some people, this one will stick, and with some people, this one will stick. And that's why the commitment to the truth, what the person who puts this stuff out there actually believes, if they don't believe anything or they don't care, it makes them much better at doing this kind of strategy, because their purpose isn't to convince you that the election was stolen by X, Y, or Z means. Their purpose is to make you confused so that you don't trust the outcome. They don't care why you don't trust the outcome. They're not trying to convince you that it was stolen because they don't think they can do anything in that route. They just want to convince enough people that they shouldn't trust what happened. And the way to do that is the more effective way to do that is to confuse them.
We are talking with Scott Tyson, assistant professor of political science at the University of Rochester. We've got time for a couple more phone calls at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. And we go to Keith in Victor. Keith, you had a recent interesting experience related to our discussion today.
Yeah, I have one quick question. Did the professor see the series on HBO? Did he mention that about exploring QAnon?
He did. Yeah, that did come up as a recommendation.
I was in Fort Lauderdale. I went to this well-known flea market. It's everybody selling anything, from guys selling magnetic bracelets because he's there and not at a doctor's office because the FDA won't give him approval of it, to a guy, an elderly white guy, standing there talking to these two elderly white people. And we're in the middle of like Trump land up there near Fort Lauderdale. And he says to them, did you hear about he was relating the story how Trump stopped the 50,000 Chinese that were digging tunnels into Maine. And I immediately start looking around for the cameras because I just thought this was like an over the top prank. And it wasn't. So there's no way you're going to get the genie back in the bottle with people who believe and repeat that utter nonsense. I just can't believe somebody would believe that, because there's a little thing between Canada and the main border called the St. Lawrence Seaway. And I'm thinking, if there's 50,000 Chinese walking across a bridge to dig a tunnel into Maine, wouldn't somebody have seen them?
Especially right now, you think, right? Keith, yeah. Thanks for the call. We're getting a little short on time, so I want to give Scott Tyson a chance to respond to this. And I think that it raises this big question, and it's a question that's come up in a couple of tweets also. It's hard for people to admit when they've actually been wrong or they've been had about something. It's a difficult ego situation to be in. So how do you get people back out of this who've gotten into it?
That's absolutely true. It's really hard to admit you've been duped if you've been duped. But one thing I think is important to emphasize, and I should have said this before, but when you try to examine, you know, here's a conspiratorial narrative and look how absurd and kooky it is, how could people really believe this? I think that we misunderstand how conspiracies work politically a little bit. And that is, conspiracy theories aren't always about here's the truth. They're more about a way to signal membership in a group. You know, we're all in a group. How do we signal our membership? We say, you know, we all believe this thing. And when we say believe, we don't mean believe in the same way that, you know, oh, I believe the vaccines work, right? Like as a statement of truth. What believe means there is I say, you know, I support this conspiratorial narrative. But it really has nothing to do with whether or not they think it's true or not. It's just a way to ascribe membership. And in that way, the kookier the conspiracy, the stronger the signal of membership. How do I show that I'm a committed member because I've put my name to say I believe this kooky thing?
And in the most extreme examples, obviously, again, getting back to January 6th, we saw what happened when people who really, really believed got together in large numbers on a day that obviously could have ended a heck of a lot worse than it actually did, as bad as it was. Was that, in your mind, kind of the peak of the fever, or is this just one spike on a trend that still has room to grow?
I think it's one spike on a trend. I don't think we've seen the last of this.
What do we do as a nation, especially coming back around then to this question of vaccines, where, you know, it's not just a question of your beliefs in this case being harmful or not. It's a real issue that we're seeing now in the divergence between up here in this part of the world where we're at 70% and we've seen our numbers drop dramatically. And then we're seeing numbers rise still in areas where this belief, you know, whatever it is about what the vaccines really are, seems to be more pervasive. I mean, that to my mind seems like a real public health effect of people believing some of these theories. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
I think that's fair, and I think it's something we should be worried about. You know, I'm not an expert on American public opinion or anything like that, but I think that, again, going back to my previous point, one thing that I'm somewhat suspicious that it's not so much that people are hesitant of the vaccine because they think it's not going to work or whatever conspiracy they have related to what the vaccine actually does. I'm sure those people exist. I'm not saying that they don't. But I think that there is this aspect of how do you demonstrate that you're a loyal Trump voter or a loyal whatever kind of voter. And this is one way that they've found to do that. They can distinguish themselves from the people they don't like by saying, I'd rather, you know, take the risk of getting this virus. That's how committed I am. I think that's what's part of the explanation.
I imagine you're going to have a lot when you teach this class again. Are you teaching it again in the fall? Is it on your schedule?
I'm not teaching it this fall, but I most likely will be teaching it the next fall.
It's got to be a class that changes with the times as you're teaching it, right?
Yeah, so far I've taught it twice. I taught it in fall of 2020 and then in fall of 2019. And I was surprised how much it changed just in a year because so many things had changed. The first time I taught it was during the first impeachment hearings. And so that was like a source of a lot of examples and discussion. And then the second time I taught it was the election. And so it was just a completely different set of examples. The thing that stuck out the most to me that I was most surprised about is naturally I do a day on QAnon. And, you know, as I was kind of prepping the course for fall of 2020, I did some looking into like, okay, you know, what could I update on my QAnon day? And basically I had to redo the day completely from scratch because the basic narrative of QAnon had completely changed over the course of the year.
And this was the year, obviously, when so many people were inside during the pandemic. Does that have an effect, too, when people were not making regular human contact in the way they might normally with a broader spectrum of people who might disagree with them on things? Is there a tendency for people to find more of these things when they're just stuck inside with nothing to do but scroll on the computer?
Absolutely. That's a great point. So one thing I draw the analogy between what conspiracism is doing in the United States and other radicalization techniques that have been used in other parts of the world and by other kinds of organizations. And, you know, if you think of how a cult leader develops followers, the first thing that they do is they isolate someone from their friends, their family, people that they would talk to outside of the organization. And the pandemic essentially put this on everyone else. It forced us all to be isolated. And so that's why we see this amplification of conspiracism, because we've all been isolated and we haven't been having casual, regular conversations with people in the way that we used to.
So the prescription here is get out, see more people, broaden the network of people you talk to, and hopefully that will help temper this.
Broaden the network of people and have casual conversations. If you're going to, you know, go out after work to have a drink or, you know, whatever, have those casual conversations that we just haven't had during the pandemic, because everything had to be done over Zoom by a meeting.
Yep.
You know,
we got to stop.
And those
there.
Are the people that.
All right.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you.
We're done with our hour. Scott Tyson, assistant professor of political science at the University of Rochester. Thank you so much. Emma Ray Stein is our producer. Rob Braden behind the board. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. More connections just ahead.